what would be known to virtually everybody here. Originally working on medieval and very early modern times, then on the 17th century, and then on the 20th and 21st century. His last two books, The Boom and the Bubble, The U.S. in the World Economy Today, 2002, by Verso, and The Economics of Global Turbulence, Verso, 2006. He's also the director of this center. So, Bob?
Thanks a lot, Mick. Maybe we should let people... Well, just while people are walking in and out, I hope people have the handout. If they don't, please, I hope people will share in the collective manner. I mean, these are the contradictions of capitalism. We tried to save the trees, but then, you know, we have this terrible shortage. It's a very big problem. No, we can't because I don't know how to use it. There are other reasons. Take too long to explain. Okay, thanks. So I'm going to, as we go, I'm just going to refer to the tables serially, and I hope you'll be able to have a chance to glance at them as we go. So, that's what I just said. We don't.
We're sharing. We're
going to leverage. This is prefigurative communism right here. Okay. So, why is it that over the past 18 months, economic performance has fallen so consistently, so far short of forecasters' predictions? Why has inflation, as recently as last summer, Ben Bernanke's main concern, dropped off the radar screen? Why have record run-ups in oil and other commodities, only yesterday attributed to unstoppable increases in world demand, disappeared like so many bubbles in the air? Why are the supposedly decoupled and self-sustaining BRICS, including China, plunging like the rest, indeed, even faster? Why is the unprecedented dive in housing prices continuing to prove so much greater than expected by most experts, devastating the financial sector while undermining household demand? Why is the world economy today in free fall, literally in free fall, despite the titanic injections of capital and credit by the world's governments and central banks, including $6 trillion, according to Goldman Sachs, already by the U.S. Treasury and Fed? Why, above all, and I hope we can get to this in the discussion period, has the Obama administration, obsessed with the economy since Election Day, proved for so long incapable of grasping the severity of the slump, and even now failed to come up with a policy package that has a hope of responding to the frightening slide toward, perhaps, depression? The short answer, in my opinion, to these questions is the profound, long-standing, but mostly unacknowledged ability of the real economy. Since the end of the post-war boom, the world system has become ever weaker over time, leaving it since the 70s increasingly dependent upon government-sponsored borrowing for its expansion and, from the later 1990s, reliant upon government-nurtured asset price run-ups to enable that indispensable borrowing. The new economy boom of the late 1990s was the artifact of the historic high-tech equity bubble. So when the stock market crashed in 2000, it propelled the economy into what one had every reason to expect would be a very serious downturn. But the recession was cut short by the ensuing record-breaking run-up of housing prices, quite unprecedented. Household wealth and household borrowing, and that intervened. When the housing bubble, however, began to deflate in 2006, it deprived what I believe to have been a basically enfeebled economy of the main engine that had been driving it forward. And the film of bubble-driven expansion could not but go backwards. Since the temporal extension, the extension in time of the housing bubble, and thus the economic expansion, had itself depended on the bubble in securities backed by residential mortgages, and since the country's leading banks, unbelievably, had been unable to resist buying up an astounding share of those mortgage-backed securities, the collapse of the housing market brought the collapse of the banks and a disruption of the supply of credit. It's the mutually reinforcing interaction between weakening capital accumulation and the disintegration of the financial sector that has made the downward slide so intractable for policymakers and the potential for depression so evident, despite the historic level of state intervention in the U.S. and around the world. Now, and that analysts of the housing crisis have understandably taken the meltdown in banking and the securities markets as their point of departure. Wall Street was indeed the initial site of the convulsion, and its ensuing collapse and prolonged death rattle have dealt a devastating blow to the global system. But from Fed Chair Ben Bernanke, Treasury Secretaries Hank Paulson, Timothy Geithner on down, economists have, with few exceptions, denied the need to look beyond finance and international financial balances to diagnose the catastrophe. They insist even now that until the crack-up of 2007-08 began to overflow the financial sector into the real economy, that the real economy was strong, the so-called fundamentals beyond question. As late as March 2008, Henry Paulson told National Public Radio that before the subprime crisis hit, we had 6 years of very solid economic growth. And the following June 2008, the Bank of International Settlements echoed his assessment in its annual report. But this is to understand an earthquake by investigating the destruction around its epicenter, while ignoring the long-term shifts and devastating slides of the tectonic plates below, and so could not be more misleading. In fact, the advanced capitalist economies have been experiencing steadily declining economic vitality over 3 decades, business cycle by business cycle, right into the present, with the important exception of the bubble years of the second half of the 1990s. So if you should just take a look at the first table, I know you won't be able to take it all in, and that's what I'm counting on, declining economic dynamism. And the second one, world investment and savings as a percentage of GDP. So that's kind of overview of the slowdown, or what I would call the long downturn. Most telling, the current business cycle has been palpably the weakest of the post-war period in the U.S., Japan, Germany, and Western Europe as a whole. Nor has the growth in the world economy meaning everything, despite all the hype, been anything to write home about, despite China's unquestionably spectacular and epic-making expansion. In fact, if it's appropriately measured, the growth of world GDP in this last business cycle has been the slowest of the post-war period, except for the 1990s. And if you could take a look at the bar graph on world GDP growth, taken from the data bank of that Marxist institution, the World Trade Organization. Speaking only of the U.S., between 2000 and 2007, there was literally no increase in private sector employment measured in hours. And if you look only at the non-financial corporate sector, employment actually fell a little bit. So no higher employment in 2007 than 2000. The growth of plant and equipment was a third off the previous worst for comparable intervals. Real wages for production and on supervisory workers were flat, and perhaps most striking, there was zero, literally no increase in median family income for the first time in the post-war period, so that even during the period of the later 70s, 80s, and middle 90s, when real wages were falling, they were compensated by people entering into the workforce, women entering into the workforce, and longer and multi-jobs, longer shifts, and of course by the step up of borrowing. But in the most recent period, family income, median family income, did not rise at all. And this is the case despite probably the biggest government-sponsored stimulus in peacetime history. U.S. budget deficits, as everyone knows, going from the balance, the surplus, late Clinton, to the deficits of Bush, central bank running the money presses, bringing down real interest rates below zero for many years, not just the U.S., but the whole of the advanced capitalist economies, including Asia, and of course, bubble-driven household borrowing, according to The Economist, by far the biggest bubble on a global scale in world history, way outdoing the previous largest, which was the last one in the 90s. Now, obviously, there's no time for a lengthy analysis here of this development of the post-war economy, or even from 1973. So I'll just make some stipulations and have to try to defend them better later on in the question period. In my view, the basic source of the problem is the system-wide fall and failure to recover of the rate of profit, a development that seems to me all the more remarkable and all the more telling in view of the spectacular collapse of real wage growth throughout the period. Another way of saying this is that even the reduced rates of profit that we see could be accommodated only with much lower wage growth. Another way of putting the same thing is that profitability would have been much worse had employers not succeeded in forcing down real wages to the extraordinary extent they have. So if you can take a look at the table called private and manufacturing profit rates and real compensation growth, I think that basically tells a story. And I think that's one. It's the wrong order, I think.
U.S., Germany, and Japan net profit rates.
It's called, profit rates and growth of compensation, U.S., Germany, and Japan. It might have different titles. I kind of wanted to mix it up so that people wouldn't get bored. It's called U.S., Germany, and Japan net profit rates, 1949 to 2007. This one. This is my attempt at what Gary does. Okay? I hope people found that one. Actually, I think it's the best one on this question of profitability. And if you look at the subsequent ones, there is what you should see is private profit rates, U.S., Japan, Germany, and manufacturing profit rates, U.S., Japan, Germany. Is that okay? Anyway, we can talk about it afterwards. I don't want you to look that carefully at this stuff. Now, falling returns to the capital stock advance of plant equipment and software advanced by companies left firms with smaller surpluses and a reduced incentive to invest. That's why the profit rate is so central. It determines how much surplus you get for firms get for their, on average, for their laying down of the plant equipment, now they say software, that they need to make a profit, and with the result that firms cut back on the expansion of plant and equipment and of employment, smaller surpluses, smaller incentive to invest, smaller investment growth, smaller employment growth. Meanwhile, as I just said, to restore profitability or prevent it from falling further, firms cut back on compensation, the growth of compensation, as states did on social expenditures in the to the same end. The result was that the growth of investment, consumer, and government demand, and so demand in the aggregate, has slowed down. And it's the weakness of aggregate demand, which is itself, in my view, an expression of reduced profitability that is made for the economy's declining dynamism. Now, in my view, the fundamental source of the fall in the rate of profit has been the fall in the rate of profit in world manufacturing, itself attributable to a persistent tendency to manufacturing overcapacity. Again, no time for an extended analysis, but the basic idea is that one saw in the, throughout the post-war period, especially since the late 50s and 60s, the entry of one after another manufacturing power onto the world economy, one after another late developer, so to speak. Germany, Japan, the East Asian Knicks, Southeast Asian Little Tigers, and finally, of course, the Chinese Leviathan. The problem was that these later developing economies produced the same goods that were already being produced by the earlier developers, only cheaper. They combined the best techniques, or close to it, with skilled, low-wage labor. They were, in other words, producing redundantly rather than in a complementary fashion, as in the textbooks. The result was too much supply compared to demand in one industry after another, forcing down prices, and that way, profits. Meanwhile, great corporations experiencing squeeze on their profits refused to meekly leave their lines. They fought rather than switched, falling back essentially on what's called their proprietary capital, above all, their capacity to innovate. So rather than trying to, if you're General Motors, they probably shouldn't have tried anything, but so the first example that comes to mind is they could not do what Microsoft did. So they sought to innovate and on that basis fight for market share and therefore investing more and making things worse. Now, it's not in this time very easy, it's impossible actually to really bring forth data to show this, but probably the best easy way to see what is going on is to, I should have made it a little bit easier, but if you can see this graph called non-financial corporate manufacturing and non-financial non-manufacturing net profit rates, these three lines. This is for the U.S. What you have is that the outside of manufacturing, the non-manufacturing profit rate, barely changes the whole time. There's virtually no shift between non-financial corporate manufacturing and non-financial, non-manufacturing corporate net profit rate.
Last page.
What? Not there?
Oh, you had
the most. Oh, well. Just because it's only an accident, that's my best piece of evidence. So. Okay, so. Okay. All right, calm down. It's not that big a scandal. Think of what the Wall Street did every day. Now it's the last page. Okay. Okay,
good. Can I have a quiz on this?
If you stick around, yes. Definitely. 5:30. Now, under normal circumstances, ever greater entry and failure to exit would, of course, have tended to make for recession and crisis, and that's essentially what's historically been the case throughout most of the history of capitalism up to 1945. Problems of profitability were dispersed by crisis, in which the weakest firms, least productive, least profitable, fell by the wayside, leaving, in this Darwinian fashion, those that remained, the strong ones, opening the way for a new boom. But this outcome, as we all know, was prevented throughout the post-war, throughout the period, especially from the late 60s and early 70s, by ever greater borrowing, public and private, sponsored by the government. So we had one or another form of Keynesianism. Now, so if you take a quick look at the line graph, rise of borrowing and debt outstanding, the next one, you can see the basic trend.
This one?
Yes.
U.S. total domestic borrowing and debt outstanding.
Maybe Mickey can be the technological high skill can always beat out the machine. Okay, so, but I want to emphasize that this growth of American borrowing, the growth of deficits, both private and public and private, was crucial not just to U.S. stability and growth. It was absolutely essential to the development of the world economy, and increasingly so over time. That is, as time went on, especially from 1980, what one gets as we enter the more increasingly into the neoliberal period, the attack on social spending, the attack on wages, the speed up means that domestic markets are under attack. Domestic markets are growing ever more slowly in most economies, forcing them, obliging them to depend for their growth on exports ever increasingly. And this, of course, applies more than ever before in history to the dynamic East Asian economies came online in the 70s and 80s. No time ever before was there anything like this sort of dependence on exports, and therefore, in turn, on the American market. What you got, indeed, was what you might call a new international Keynesian, New Bretton Woods system. People, you've heard that term, New Bretton Woods system, in which you ultimately have pretty much emerging after 1995, but starting between 1980 and 1985, a situation in which the U.S. not only borrows massively, but accepts a high dollar. So, crucially important. And what this means is that it makes possible the rapid expansion of manufacturing production around the world, based on the growth of the U.S. market. But precisely because of the high dollar and this massive borrowing, it also means that U.S. Production is decreasingly competitive. It also means that over time, what you get driving the world economy to an extraordinarily degree is the U.S. current account deficit. So the U.S., not just the U.S. market, but U.S. borrowing, U.S. Current account deficit, and the final piece of the puzzle is that one after another, developing manufacturing power willing to finance this deficit so that they can keep their keep their currencies down, their competitiveness up. You have a huge irony there, or paradox, or, you know, in the Marxist dogma, contradiction. Because if you're going to drive the world economy through the U.S., and in this fashion, you're also undermining the capacity of the U.S. precisely to serve as this market of last resort. And this is one of the key underlying problems in the development of the world economy in the last period. Anyway, the problem of borrowing, the problem of Keynesianism, traditional Keynesianism, based in the U.S., there's nothing fancy about that term, I just mean deficits, is that although ever greater borrowing made for stability, it also made for stagnation. So there was no repeat of the sort of crisis that characterized capitalism throughout its history, but at the same time, there was ever slower growth. Why? The shakeout, first of all, one, the obvious part and parcel of the growth of borrowing was the growth of indebtedness. For the system was increasingly indebted, meaning that over time, the response of its households, of its corporations, were ever less flexible, ever less powerful. In my view, perhaps even more important, what was prevented was a shakeout of the high-cost, low-profit means of production that had previously restored profitability and made for new dynamism. So for most of the period since 1973, we've had a long slowdown, a long downturn, but no Great Depression. Traded off economic dynamism in order to get stability. Now, that's the background to what I think is the key kind of moment, the key break in the pattern of post-war capital accumulation, the political economy, at least after 1973. Up to this time, even under Ronald Reagan, who came to the presidency with the intention, he said, of balancing the budget, good old conservative economics, but was the greatest Keynesian ever. So even through the 80s into the early 90s, despite all the complaints, this system continued. The addiction to debt continued. But their big break occurred just at this moment. And it took, in effect, a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, to do what was necessary to restore fiscal probity, you might say. So what Clinton and then the Europeans did was try to balance the budget, which they ultimately both did, and moved toward a situation in which the incubus of the state would be removed and the dynamism of the underlying economy could be unleashed. But the problem was that profitability had still not been restored, and so what you got was a huge hit. When you cut down the deficits, a huge hit to demand, and since profitability was still low, had not been recovered, you got the worst recessions, the worst economic performance of the post-war period. And this was notably the case in Japan, Germany, and Europe, because they were simultaneously weighed down by their elevated currency. In fact, the crisis was so severe that by 1995, the U.S. was agreed to push up the dollar against the mark and the yen to keep the great manufacturing powers, our leading rivals, turning over. And this was a very major change in the global political economy. But at this point, the world economy and U.S. policy makers face a huge dilemma. What is going to drive it? During the previous decade, against the background of international slowdown, the U.S. economy had laid the groundwork for a significant recovery, and this is quite the case and should not be forgotten. So what you got was a major, if incomplete, increase in the private sector rate of profit based entirely on a huge, if incomplete, increase in the manufacturing profit rate that was resulted from an increase in American competitiveness. The problem was that this had been primarily based on an enormous decline of the dollar against the currencies of its major competitors. So there had been a very important move toward redynamizing the economy, but now because the flip side of it had been, but since this was not accompanied by a revival on a world scale, and the flip side of the rise of American competitiveness based on the low dollar was crisis in our leading rivals, we had to make this move toward a high dollar, but the high dollar cut the recovery short and indeed sent it into reverse. At the same time, Keynesianism, the deficits, were politically ruled out by the commitment to budget balancing. In my view, from this point on, the economy essentially had no motor, and or little motor, and would have no motor up until today. And this opened the way into what you might call the era of bubblenomics. In 1995, the stock market took off, as we know. In December 1996, Greenspan warned of the rational exuberance. Nevertheless, as we also now know, he denied that there actually was a bubble. And more to the point, he denied that there was anything that could be done about it. But since we have the transcripts of the Federal Reserve, we see him there, right at this point, explicitly saying, yes, there is a bubble. Yes, we could curb the bubble by increasing margin requirements. But he refuses to do this because, as he says, this could jeopardize the nascent expansion. And what's going on here is a turn, basically, to the desperate remedy pioneered by the Japanese under similar circumstances. Keep the cost of borrowing down, reduce it any time the securities markets are in trouble, and allow, or actually help, the stock market to rise. Firms and households become increasingly wealthy. It's easier to borrow, and therefore for both households and especially at that time corporations, it's easier to consume and to invest. And in 1995 to 2000, we actually do get quite an impressive boom in the U.S. and in turn the world economy. However, this is a direct expression of the stock market run-up. But even by 1998, that is 3 years later, the underlying weakness of the real economy is already manifesting itself. From late 1997, profits start to fall, especially as the dollar rises and the East Asian crisis hits. These two are actually closely related, if we could get to that in the question period. So we get, in the fall of 1998, a financial meltdown, a freezing up of the financial markets, and a dress rehearsal, in fact, for the current crisis. Remember the long-term capital management collapse and that hedge fund and the bailout that was necessary. This threatened to lead to a new recession. Here, Greenspan explicitly turned to bubblenomics. He cut interest rates famously three times in the fall of 98, again in late 99, and called on the GSEs, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, to lend like crazy to homeowners. So we get quite a boom, but based on an info technology bubble, which drives the tech expansion, which drives the world economy. But of course, despite all the talk about financial markets as an incomparable mechanism for allocating capital, the high-tech boom, by endowing high-tech firms with endless opportunities to borrow and raise money by issuing stock, channeled money into lines where there was no hope of making a profit, and added money to lines where there was already overcapacity. The result was to exacerbate already existing overcapacity and drive down the rate of profit further at the very time the stock market was reaching historic highs. And you can see that in the graph called Stock Market and about on stock markets and profits that comes next. As former chair Paul Volcker, now back in the saddle, pithily summed up at the time, the fate of the world economy is now totally dependent on the growth of the U.S. economy, which is dependent on the stock market, whose growth is dependent upon about 50 stocks, half of which have never reported any earnings. So, of course, we got the new economy crash that followed the new economy boom, and the wealth effect went into reverse. The most rapid fall in the growth of investment, GDP, aggregate compensation in the post-war period between the middle of 2000 and the middle of 2001 and so forth. Now the economy, it looks, as I said at the start, it looked like the economy would enter a serious recession. And if you go back and look at the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal, this is what they're worrying about every day. But the economy was now saved, in my opinion, by its own weakness. And the key here, Gary already alluded to, was a spectacular fall in long-term interest rates. On the one hand, this was a result of a major decline in the demand for loanable funds, so that at this point, in the wake of a series of crises in the world economy, and then as a result of the weakness of the subsequent so-called expansion, the demand by businesses for borrowing to invest was at a very, very low ebb. So there's not much demand for long-term credit. The opposite side of the same coin is that to stem the deepening recession, the U.S. was obliged, as usual, to reflate its way into expansion, and this had to occur by taking on big government deficits as well as encouraging big private ones. But this meant a continuation and indeed a major increase of the same old current account deficits. The problem was that during the new economy boom, private investors from around the world had been willing to fund this, the new economy bubble. They thought they would make a fortune through investing in the rising stock market. But now, with the stock market in tatters, the economy going into recession, they had no interest in buying American securities or lending money to American borrowers. So, what you had as the reflation began was a serious threat of a flight of capital, increased interest rates, and extinguishing the recovery before it starts. So the weakness of the U.S. economy is manifesting itself at this point, and it's here that we see the rise in supply of loanable funds that kept everything going on. So with the threat of the flight of capital, rising interest rates, so forth, extinguishing the recovery before it started, the East Asians came in and saved the day by massive extension of cheap credit, buying dollar-denominated securities, especially Treasury securities and GSE debt. The point, of course, was to keep their own currencies down in aid of their own manufacturing export-dependent economies. So you have less demand for loans, plenty of supply, and you get this very extraordinary development that goes on right through the business cycle of a steady decline in real long-term interest rates. And this, it seems to me, sets the kind of conditions for the subsequent developments. So if you look at the line graph called real long-term and short-term interest rates, you could see that. Maybe you can show that.
Yeah. Tell them what a GSE is.
It's Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Thanks, Tom. Now, what made these long-term real interest rates so crucial was, of course, that in the United States, we have standardly long-term mortgage rates and the long-term real interest rates made for cheap long-term borrowing by households and drove a new bubble in housing. So what you have is an extraordinary, as a result, an extraordinary increase in housing prices. People thought going into this period that housing prices were always rise, it was normal. But the fact is that never before in the post-war period did housing prices in real terms ever rise, nor did they ever rise faster than rents. But from the mid-1990s, you have this unprecedented takeoff. So if you take a look at the next figure, which is U.S. real house prices, sale and rent, you can see that for the, maybe you should show them, pick it up. For the whole of the post-war period up to that moment, there was no increase in real in housing prices adjusted for the CPI or the GDP deflator. So as with the stock market, rising house prices made for an enormous increase in household on-paper wealth, which allowed record borrowing, and the collapse of savings by households. The next couple tables show this. The growth of household borrowing as a percentage of household disposable income, and then probably even more spectacular, the collapse of the personal savings as a percent of personal disposable income. Actually, as you see, this began to take place at the with the first bubble, with the stock market bubble. Up to 1992, basically, you had quite the high relative personal savings, but everyone now thought that they were getting rich. They didn't have to save. Their securities were doing it for them. In the 90s, stocks, in the 2000s, residential investment. I'm sorry, their houses, the increased wealth in their houses. So housing housing wealth drove household spending on consumption and on residential investment, and these two basically single-handedly pulled the economy from recession, meaning consumption and residential investment spending were all that was going on in this period, and in fact, pretty much all that was going on in the whole of the expansion. But the fact remains that nothing had happened to deal with the economy's underlying weakness. So despite the stimulus by this amazing housing run-up, but in 2002 and 2003, as well, I should say, as Bush's huge deficits, the economy was sputtering. And remember, there were these widespread fears of deflation. Then Bernanke said, don't worry. But what other people were worrying, and the Fed cut interest rates by a half point in late 2002 to stop the deterioration. But even by the end of 2003, there had been no growth in profits, no job growth, no investment growth, no export growth, no net export growth. On the other hand, the housing bubble, which had driven the economy forward, was in trouble. Rising prices were pricing people out of the market. And it looked like they might actually cease to be able to drive the economy. Mortgage originations actually peaked in 2003, something that was stunning to me, and fell subsequently, in 2004 already, conforming mortgages were collapsing. So if you look at that line graph called mortgage originations, you can see that. And here comes Greenspan again in 2003-2004, just as in 1998, to save the expansion. He lowered long-term interest rates to 1% and kept them there for several years, so you had several years of below zero real interest rates. Equally telling, he said, we don't need, we shouldn't fetishize fixed rate mortgages. Variable rates are just great. It just so happens, of course, that subprime mortgages were governed by variable rates. He said also, we should, that the housing market should provide, I'm sorry, the mortgage market should provide households with ever more varied forms of mortgage, and of course, that's just what they did. He also, as Gary amply discussed, said, we don't have to bother enforcing laws against predatory lending that might discourage the housing market. So what we got, quite amazing, was an explosion of subprime lending at just this moment, 2003-2004, when mortgage originations were falling. And this seems to me to have saved the expansion by saving the housing bubble. So if you look at the line graph called mortgage originations, and then the bar graph, you can see that over the subsequent years, subprime and Alt-A originations, non-conforming mortgages, took over the majority, 40 to 50%, I should say, of all mortgage originations. So again, a government-nurtured bubble saved the economy. But this poses a huge problem. It's understandable how subprime mortgages opened up to the housing market, to a lot of new people. They bought houses, kept their housing growing. The problem is, who in their right mind would have lent to them? And for this, we need to look to another bubble that was growing up at this time, which was, of course, the bubble in the securities market. So the flip side of low long-term real interest rates, which underpinned the housing boom, great for borrowers, but what about investors? Pension funds, insurance companies, hedge funds, local governments. Just as it became easy to borrow, they got into desperate trouble because of the corresponding decline in the rate of return on lending. Moreover, with short-term interest rates so low, banks and other financiers borrowed cheap and lent long to financial market players who in turn bought various long-term bonds, driving down the rate of return on loans and bonds of all sorts ever further. In short, you're getting a credit market bubble expanding, driving down even further the rate of return for lenders of every sort. And here's where the famous securities based on non-conforming mortgages come in. The famous collateralized mortgage obligations, the CDOs, and all of that. Because of the relatively high rates offered by non-conforming mortgages, you were able to create securities based on them, which offered the high return that was lacking all across and declining all across the rest of the securities market. Asset-backed securities have been built on corporate debt, third world debt, but these by 2003 were really falling to ridiculously low levels if you're a financier or an investment bank and wanting to make money. So investors turn to securities based on subprime mortgages to get the high interest rates, the high rates of return. And indeed, they got an extraordinary rate of return, so much so that investors simply couldn't get enough of them, and they bought them in massive amounts. And so what you get here is that you have investment in turn drives investment banks to buy up ever more of these mortgages so they can repackage them and sell them into the world market. It's the demand for mortgages to be packaged into mortgage-backed securities that makes it possible for mortgage lenders to continue lending to ever less qualified borrowers, despite the ever greater likelihood that they would not be able to pay their mortgages. So mortgage lenders sell on to investment banks who package their loans into securities and sell them to financial investors. So what we have, indeed, by 2003, it's actually the mortgage-backed securities market that's driving the mortgage market. What's happened is that at that point, the return has on on bonds has gotten so low that investors have to turn to these mortgage-backed securities. They do. That continues to drive up housing mortgages, I mean, expand the mortgage market and drive up housing prices. So if you look at the next graph, line graph, subprime all-day mortgage originations, subprime all-day bond issuance, and the U.S. housing market, you can see that what's going on is that, you can't see it exactly, but there you can see the manifestation of the argument, at least, that I'm making, and certainly it's not original with me, that in effect what you're having is a, from about 2003-2004, a bubble in the securities markets, which makes it possible for the bubble in the subprime and alt-A mortgages to continue and housing prices to keep going. Of course, there's an obvious catch. How can these securities give such a high rate of return? The obvious answer is only because of high risk. That you learn, I guess, on day one when you do finance economics. It couldn't be more self-evident, given that in order to expand the subprime housing market, you have to let in less qualified people in terms of their incomes and so forth, on terms that are ever easier, putting up ever less money. So, indeed, tellingly, even though this is going on, even though you're lending to less and less viable borrowers, what's going on is that the spread between the interest rates on conforming market, on non-conforming mortgages are falling compared to conforming ones. So if there was ever a clear sign that a bubble was blowing up, this was it. The final twist, and I guess I'll probably have to, I'll have to stop there and continue in the question period. The final twist is that this famous securitization, originate to distribute model, was supposed to actually hold off the difficulties that might have arisen in this in these markets. In other words, to counter the risk that was emerging, it was thought that really we don't have anything to worry about, or so we were told. The banks were supposed to originate the mortgages and then distribute them to investment banks who would distribute them on to the world market. So risk would be distributed and risk not concentrated. Risk would be distributed to those who could best afford it and who wanted it. Indeed, one interesting thing is not, I think only very recently have you seen major disasters among those who were actually getting these securities that were distributed. Where the disaster was concentrated was in the banks themselves, in the commercial banks and in the investment banks. Why? Because they couldn't resist buying them themselves. They couldn't, in other words, after they had created them, they couldn't let them go. And as Gary explained, in order to take on ever more of these bubbling securities, they had to do this extraordinary thing, which was turn to the asset-backed commercial paper market, meaning they had to finance these on the basis of short-term loans. So you have the extraordinary phenomenon that the banks, the commercial banks, by means of their SIVs and the investment banks, they can do it themselves since they're completely unregulated, are buying up these asset-backed securities, long-term investment, funding them in the short term. This is what banks actually do. They're acting as banks, but without the insurance that's provided by the FDIC without the Fed window to back them up in distress. So the rise of the shadow banking system, in effect, allows the bubble to go into 2007. And maybe I'll take three more minutes.
No.
Okay. One more minute? Okay, I'll stop.
We're now going to take a break.